This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In his budget address this year, while discussing welfare benefits, Governor Shumlin addressed concerns of poverty in the state.
Vermont is a caring state. The well-being of our most vulnerable families matters to us deeply. And we know that for some, the road out of poverty will be longer than it is for others.
Now, while the legislature and the governor debate the right balance of funds and deadlines for social safety net programs in the state, today on Vermont Edition, we're going to learn about one way businesses and nonprofits are getting together to help employees find their footing and climb out of poverty. Working Bridges is a program started by the United Way of Chittenden County to address some of the conflicts that arise in the workplace when workers are living in poverty. Difficulty finding childcare or transportation, a lack of funds when an emergency arises. These are things that can derail someone trying to keep a job and get ahead. And it's bad for companies, too, when they're trying to train and retain good workers. So the Working Bridges program aims to help both employers and employees find ways to manage these difficulties and create a stronger workforce and working environment. Joining us now to go a little deeper is Lisa Falcone, the director of Working Bridges. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lisa, why does an employer have a responsibility to work with an employee on what's going on in his or her personal life?
Well, I think when employers hire somebody, they're making an investment as well to the person and to the company, and they want their employees to succeed. They hire people to be part of a team, and so they are very interested in making sure that they can succeed.
How does it benefit beyond? I said, you know, it helps them retain workers, but how does a company actually benefit from working with its employees to figure out things like flexible work schedules or working around when childcare options might be available and timing its shifts differently? How does that actually help a company?
Right. So I think when, again, the workforce is so important to the success of a company, and most companies make huge investments into their benefits and into their policies to make sure their company runs and there's great return on investment. Part of that investment might mean tweaking something, a policy to meet the needs of all of their workforce that may not, what may seem like a investment in their management team may not be the same for somebody who's in a lower wage position. So changing a shift schedule might be something that could accommodate a bus schedule so that people can get to work. Shifting it even by 15 minutes might make all the difference in the world.
How did Working Bridges, the program that you're the director mm-hmm. of, get started to address some of these issues?
So back in 2006, it was the United Way of Chittenden County that wanted to take a deeper dive into the issue of poverty. And they brought into the Chittenden County area a company called AHA Process. They're a national company that does trainings called Bridges Out of Poverty. And they invited community leaders, service providers, and business folks to the table to talk about poverty. And from that curriculum and from that training, it was the business community that wanted to take some action. And Working Bridges was really born out of that, out of those trainings. Remember, it was pre-2008, the Great Recession. And so they were really looking at, we have a workforce that we want to stabilize. We hire folks and they're there one day and they might not be there the next, and they weren't really clear why that was happening. So this all resonated with them in terms of that they may be needing to make some changes in their workplace to accommodate their workforce.
What kinds of things did you find early on and now even as new companies come into the program that employers weren't aware of that might be affecting their workforce?
Well, I think really what it comes down to are what I call the three R's, and that is that relationship really does matter. And it matters in terms of when you're somebody who – relationship resources, and what I say, if you add those up, you can equal retention or job retention. And so when you talk about resources, for you or me, if we – our car broke down, that might be an issue where we call AAA or we have a spouse or somebody who can help us get to work. For a lot of people who have limited resources, a car breaking down may be the situation where they can't get to work. And they may not even call in. They just may kind of give up. So that's the kind of things we were dealing with. And employers were starting to see it through a different lens. They were starting to think about, oh, that may be that really good employee who's been late the last 3 days, maybe it is a issue of transportation or a childcare issue. Before it might be they take their policy, you're late 3 times and you're released. And now they were starting to look at those policies differently.
We're talking today about some of the barriers that people who live in poverty, near the poverty line, face, even as they find full-time work. And we're looking at a statewide program called Working Bridges, run by the United Way of Chittenden County, that gives support to employers in finding ways to help their employees maintain their jobs and lower the stress in their lives. Listeners, we'd love to hear what your employer does to understand some of the challenges low-income employees can face or how it works in your environment. You can let us know by giving us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And now we're going to get into a little bit more of how the program actually works, what employers do, what employees do. And let's bring in somebody who's working in the program, one employer that's actually been with the program for a few years. Elizabeth Madigan is Director of Employee and Labor Relations at Fletcher Allen Healthcare, which is part of the program. Elizabeth, nice to talk with you.
Thank you.
So tell us first, when did you discover or what did you discover that Fletcher Allen wasn't really aware of or doing that was actually, you know, kind of contributing to some of the difficulties your workers were having?
Sure. And I think for our experience, it was sort of a number of different things, Jane, that aligned at the same time. So as Lisa mentioned, there was this training back in 2006, went to the training and sort of had that aha moment where I realized that there were sort of 3 things happening here and that there were some connections that we weren't making. So one of the things that was happening is a number of employees were asking for payroll advances for a variety of different reasons. As you can imagine, it's not something that we were doing at the time. And so it was hard. These people had really good reasons to ask for a payroll advance, but we weren't able to grant it. We had a high rate of turnover in one of our departments, so we were losing a lot of employees within the first 90 days or within the first year. And we were losing them for a variety of issues, but specifically relating to either child care issues, a few transportation issues, and something that we just categorized as attendance, that either difficulty getting to work, had to leave early for a variety of reasons, or just failing to show up at all. And when we started digging deeper into that, we found a lot of external pressures. So needing to take care of whatever was happening outside of work, and that work just couldn't be the priority. In addition, our supervisors were expressing that they were spending a lot of their time trying to help our employees troubleshoot these difficult situations that weren't necessarily work-related but were having a significant impact on work. And the supervisors felt, they wanted to do that. They wanted to help these employees, but they weren't prepared to. So they were spending a lot of their time and energy trying to navigate for these employees whatever the situations were. And they were frustrated because they might, you know, they weren't always successful, and it wasn't what they were prepared to do. So there were a number of things happening that literally when we went through the training, we sort of put them all together and realized that we weren't looking at some of our issues the right way, and that this model just presented a whole new opportunity for us to explore and to try.
Well, let's go through a couple of the ways then that the program works and how then you, Elizabeth, can work with employees. For one thing, Elizabeth mentioned that their own people, their HR people, were spending a lot of time talking with employees about some of these external pressures. And Working Bridges has a resource coordinator that can come in to the company and work with employees to address some of those issues so that it's not something that's done with HR. Lisa Falcone, can you talk a little bit about that first?
Sure. So the resource coordinator is what I call the jewel of Working Bridges. This is literally a person. In Chittenden County, we have somebody up in the Northeast Kingdom, and another person, another resource coordinator in southeastern Vermont. And she, the one in Chittenden County, is shared across 7 employers, goes on site, is there to do to meet the employees, to know the employees, and to help them with the issues that may get in the way. This could mean one-on-one talking with people for 15 minutes about issues of housing, childcare, transportation, financial issues, education for their children. And she is the person who helps them get the resources so that they can be present at work, do their job, and not worry about this. So she's a team with them. In addition, Elizabeth mentioned the HR perspective. She's helping HR kind of understand some of these issues too, so there's also a teaming there as well. So that is really the beauty of working bridges. She also informs the employers about all of these issues that we bring back to what we call the employer work group. But the one thing, you've all probably heard of Vermont 211. It is modeled off of Vermont 211, the resource, what they call, I believe, specialist. So she's getting resources to people. It's all confidential. It is not based on disciplinary action or anything like that. It is really about making sure people can be at work. She also helps pre-plan. In February, she's talking about childcare for the summer. In August, she's talking about heating assistance for November, because sometimes people get caught up in their day or their work and their lives. They aren't thinking that far out. So she helps do that work.
Elizabeth Madigan, why is that better for you and better for your employees than having somebody in your HR department do that work?
Sure. Great question. So as HR professionals, you know, we're trained to cover certain things, and we're really focused on what happens within the workplace, but we're not experts on all the things that happen outside of the workplace. And so we made a conscious decision that it would be much more beneficial for both ourselves, for our supervisor, you know, supervisors as well as our employees, to bring the expert into the workplace and not try to do something that we're not equipped to do. Just to touch on something that Lisa Falcone just said, you know, I think the proactive part of the resource coordinator, so going to staff meetings and talking about things like different programs for summer for children. We have employees who are coming in on their days off to attend staff meetings that Lisa's going to be at. So that in itself is proof to us that this is successful and it's working. I mean, who wants to come in on their day off to work, much less they want to come in to hear about something that they know is going to be it's really important to them and it's important to their families.
You also mentioned, Elizabeth Madigan, a microloan program that a lot of your employees were coming to you asking for a payday advance, basically, to cover some emergency costs, and you weren't doing that. Mm-mm. And as part of Working Bridges, there is a microloan program. Explain how that works for you at Fletcher Allen.
Sure. So we partner with NEFCU, so New England Federal Credit Union, and it's essentially a guaranteed loan program for our employees. There are certain criteria that they must meet first. So there is a minimum number of months that you have to have been employed by Fletcher Allen, and you also have to be, quote-unquote, in good standing with the organization. So as long as you meet that criteria, you have your director basically sign off on an application for a loan, and you can immediately go to NEFCU and essentially be guaranteed a loan. You know, from NEFCU's perspective, the only other caveat is if you've obviously had any negative banking experience with them, they may not give you the loan. It's very, very rare. So these are employees that wouldn't qualify in most cases for a loan through a bank. So they're, one, receiving a loan from a bank, so they're building credit, and they're paying it back through payroll deductions. So one of the unintended consequences that we experience through this program that's really, really incredible is that once our employees paid back their loans, they then started saving money. So they didn't turn off the account at that point. Instead, the same amount of money they were just deferring into a savings account. So 85% of our employees have taken a loan now have established a savings account with a bank, which for most, if not all of them, is a first.
And has anybody defaulted on the loan?
So we've had one default out of 210 loans.
Why was this such an important feature of Working Bridges, Lisa Falcone? I mean, it seems like something that might not have to be part of an employer plan.
Right. So when you think about the issues that can get in the way of people being present, most of them do tie into it's a financial issue. It's really difficult for people to meet their obligations. And so why it's so important and why it's been so successful is that it's given people an option of how they can face an emergency and pay for that emergency. I mean, we were really interested in avoiding what loan situations that were not good for people. And so we moved into this loan program. Employers do it with a number of different credit unions in the state. And overall, we have seen it be a huge success. Not only are people saving money, but we also can prove that people are building their credit, because for many of these folks, they cannot get traditional credit.
We got a note from Ellen, who posted, I guess what could also be seen here as the elephant in the room. Ellen says real wages have stagnated over the past 15 years, but it's still common to hear employers say that a $10 an hour or $12 an hour job is a good job. Employers who pay their workers hourly might want to think about what that translates to annually, about $20,800 a year or $24,960 a year, depending on whether it's $10 or $12. Because if they did, they might be hard-pressed to consider for themselves how they'd live on that little. So Elizabeth Madigan and Lisa, you as well, I mean, one thing is providing resources for people, but another thing is the wages that they're making. Are you addressing that issue, Elizabeth Madigan?
Yes, and so I'd say the wages specifically, I'm not sure that technically falls under Working Bridges.
Right.
Financial stability is certainly a part of it when we're looking at a much bigger picture. So from Fletch Allen's perspective, we do regularly compare all of our wages against the market. That is how we set our compensation model. And so, we're looking at how do all of our benefits sort of complement each other. And I think it's always a good question to think about how does an hourly wage translate into an annual wage. And so I don't know that, if you were to increase everyone's wages, I don't know what that threshold ultimately would look like from an organization where we would all unanimously agree that this is where it should be, but we're completely driven by the market and what the market dictates as a fair wage.
What about from your perspective, Lisa?
You know, I anticipated that somebody may ask this question, and I will say about the employers that I work with, it's an honor, because these are employers who are really dedicated to meeting the needs of their workforce. And I'm not a labor market specialist, so I really can't address the wage issue in that sense. But I would say this, that all of these companies are giving good benefits to their employees. And I do think that having a job is one step in the continuum to financial stability. Most of these employers are now looking at what we call Working Bridges 2.0, where we think about how can we advance these folks either through advanced skill training and that sort of thing. So I think the wage issue is a community issue. We live in a very high cost of living state. Our housing is expensive. It's cold most of the time. We need heating fuel, those sorts of things. And so I think it's going to take a bigger effort than one employer paying higher wages.
Elizabeth Madigan, have you been able to track improvements at Fletcher Allen after going through this program and thinking a little bit differently about how to work with your employees to make sure that that work-life balance is working for them and they can get to work and can function well at work? Are you able to track if there have been any benefits to that?
Yep. So we do track things such as retention and turnover, as Lisa was describing in the beginning. I'm hard-pressed to say that it's one program that's contributed 100% to those numbers. But as an example, before we implemented this program in one department, we had around 50% turnover in the first 12 months, which is incredibly high. And today, the turnover rate is down around 15%. So that's a significant difference. Of course, there's other things that we're looking at internally. I'd say the other metric that I would link to that we're also tracking is the promotion rates, right? So in the same department, how many employees were we promoting at that time versus today? Also a significant difference. I think one of the primary reasons is this program. So we're not looking to just retain, but we're also looking to grow and develop our employees internally.
Elizabeth Madigan is the Director of Employee and Labor Relations at Fletcher Allen Healthcare. Elizabeth, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much.
We are still talking with Lisa Falcone, Director of the program Working Bridges, and there's more to come on how employers can play a role in easing some of the challenges low-income employees face. Listeners, share your thoughts at vpr.net/Vermont Edition or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're looking at one specific program that helps employers and employees ease some of the tensions that go along with living near the poverty line. It helps employees find ways to keep their jobs, maintain their finances, and de-stress. And it helps employers understand how their processes can help or hinder their employees. It also assists them in retaining a good workforce. The program is called Working Bridges, and we're talking with its director, Lisa Falcone, and we're using this program as a lens to explore these wider issues around poverty. You can let us know what's helped with you or with your employer, or if you work at a business that has taken some steps to work with its employees' challenges, we'd love to hear how that's going. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Cheryl who says, I was homeless in 1974, began working as a part-time cashier at a convenience store in 1980, and now I run my own. How did I do this? I worked hard, I took advantage of opportunities that scared me half to death, and I made difficult choices when I had to do so. Climbing out of poverty needs to start with the individual. They need to make themselves valuable to their employers, and then they will be rewarded with better pay. So Lisa Falcone, what about that employees need to take the initiative to make sure that they're valuable to their employers? Does that factor into this program?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the employees who are work with our resource coordinator who participate in our loan program or who take advantage of any strategy we have in place, they are motivated. They are trying to do everything right. So I totally agree that it is partially up to the employee to move themselves forward, and they are doing that.
We also got a note from Kathy in New Haven who says, growing up in Burlington's Old North End with hardworking but undereducated parents, my siblings and I shared a level of poverty with our neighbors. But even as a young child, I saw that some of our neighbors carried heavier burdens. The difference, I was told, was that even though we were just as poor as they were, we had hope and they had lost theirs. Can you speak to the role of resilience in the success of Vermonters and others traveling the road out of poverty?
Sure. I mean, for what makes me think about why they may have been successful is their parents. There are things that show or studies that show that having good mentors, good role models, that really is an important factor in somebody's ability to move forward. And also in terms of hope, it is really something that if you've seen your parents, even if they struggle, but you have other good role models in place, that can really make a big difference.
How, though, do you work in a program like this to make sure that you're not targeting people and sort of saying, you are the working poor, you know, basically putting a target on them or highlighting poverty rather than, you know, highlighting the working part or highlighting these other things and then, you know, worrying about making them feel like a target?
Right. We don't use the term working poor, nor do we use poverty. We really are talking about trying to create an environment that can help people be more stable and present at work. We're really trying to think about resources, and that could be me this morning dealing with my three children, or, you know, all of us sometimes need to have extra help, extra resources, and that's really what this is about. And we definitely do not target folks. We are really trying to make sure that people can access those resources.
So is the program open to anyone? I mean, at Fletcher Allen, you've got a lot of different kinds of people on a lot of different salaries. Could any of them utilize that microloan program?
So Fletcher Allen's a little bit different because it's a huge employer. They definitely have the resource coordinator available to certain departments. But, you know, when you think of the wages, we think that people who are making somewhere between $10 and $19 an hour, they tend to rely on Working Bridges more frequently than maybe somebody who's gone through a divorce, or maybe somebody who you know, has another situation, a life situation that they've never dealt with before, could also utilize the resource coordinator. As I said, Fletcher Allen is just a slightly different employer.
Let's go to the calls. Gabriel is calling in from Charlestown, New Hampshire. Hi, Gabriel. Go ahead. You there, Gabriel?
Yes, good afternoon.
Yes, hi. Go right ahead.
Just calling to see what your ideas are on the roots of the problems of fitness now. Because it's amazing to hear your empathy, and it's a wonderful program. Surely if you if you treat people as though they are what they ought to be, you help them become what they're capable of. But my question to the root of the problems that face us, as Thoreau said, there are 1,000 striking at the branches of evil to one who strikes at the root.
Yeah, Gabriel, I hear what you're saying. Okay, so Lisa Falcone, what about finding ways to make sure that you can kind of put your program out of business, I guess?
Sure. I mean, when I think of I think I understand the question of being what is the root of poverty, and we could have a whole, 10 shows about that. One of the things that I do want to make clear that really we don't even call ourselves a program. We're a collaborative. We bring employers together, and together we're trying to look at this very complex issue of stability of folks and financial stability and retention of jobs and that sort of thing. So, we continue to do a lot of training. We really think about the educating the supervisors, the managers, the people in the workplace who are so that they understand what poverty is. And again, we're really focused on a couple of elements of poverty. We're focused on the fact that people who live in poverty tend to rely on relationships as their bridge. And so we want to make those positive relationships. And again, it's really about resources. And I'm not just talking financial resources. I'm talking spiritual. I'm talking, all the resources we need to exist as humans.
Let's turn to another employer in our region who's taken advantage of this program. Patty Harvey is the vice president for Y-Corps America. It's an electrical and plastics manufacturing company. And Y-Corps' manufacturing plant in St. Johnsbury uses the Working Bridges program. Patty Harvey, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
So your manufacturing plant, Weidemann, got involved with Working Bridges as part of a company wellness program. How did that happen?
So over the last couple of years, we've been talking to our employees through focus groups and surveys and one-on-one contact to explore with them how we could remove their barriers to their overall wellness, of taking that idea of a traditional wellness program that's centered around somebody's health management. We wanted to broaden that focus and really make it more about their overall well-being and trying to identify with our folks what's stopping them from achieving an overall sense of well-being. And Working Bridges was a program that I had become aware of through many years in the HR world, and it really dovetailed well with other initiatives that we were bringing on site to our facility in St. Johnsbury.
So what would you say have been the most successful aspects of this program and your sort of shift in thinking?
I think the shift in the thinking about well-being versus wellness, we've seen much more involvement, much more engagement with our employees, and we're just now a year into this kind of shift, so we're starting to gain some traction. We have a broad range of people that are accessing Working Bridges and our other benefit programs and other wellness programs. So it really, we've been able to provide different resources to meet different needs. We have a very balanced, with our resource coordinator here on site, it seems to be a very balanced mix of what people are going to her seeking assistance with.
Can you give us an example?
We have many people that, sometimes it's on a healthcare issue for themselves or a dependent, elder care issues, mental health and substance abuse issues, as well as the financial support services that are available in the community. It really is removed for people either the stigma or the inability to identify programs that already exist in our community, and really connect people in a way that they weren't either able to connect on their own before, or we were not, as an employer, able to help them connect.
Patty Harvey is the vice president for Weidemann International Corporation America. Y-Corps' manufacturing plant in St. Johnsbury uses the Working Bridges program. Patty, I really appreciate you being on our show today.
It's been my pleasure.
We got another email, this one from Catherine, who says, I work at a nonprofit where a lot of low-income people go to receive help via the Reach Up program, which provides families with children in dire straits a way out of poverty by providing them with financial assistance and helping them create a plan for the future. It's distressing to me that Governor Shumlin is prepared to cut this program as part of his tax plan when there are other viable alternatives. The middle and working class are in a tough enough spot as it is right now without things being made worse for them. Lisa Falcone is with us. She's the director of Working Bridges, this program that we've been talking about that helps employers and employees realize common struggles, common tensions, and help to fix them. What about federal programs like ReachUp and how those funds and the changing, you know, the fluctuations in those funds might affect the population that you work with?
Right, right. So once folks are employed, they obviously don't receive ReachUp funds. And we are really focused on trying, once people are unemployed, trying to keep them employed. So, you know, in terms of people who are coming into employers, we certainly think they need the supports that they are receiving. And in terms of Working Bridges, many of our employees do receive some kind of assistance. It could be childcare subsidy. It could be they could still be receiving three squares. They might have a housing voucher. So all of those programs, those income supports is what I call them, they are definitely critical in this whole concept of keeping people employed. Because as we've heard earlier, sometimes that wage is just not enough to support an individual and particularly families.
Is that something that the resource coordinator works with people in figuring out? Because, you know, there are times where a little bit of an increase in salary or too much overtime or a change in your shift that changes that the amount that you get might actually affect your federal benefits.
Absolutely. And that's definitely an area that we would like to focus on. We have focused on what we call the benefits cliff. The resource coordinator lives in both of those worlds, in the resource world and then the employer world. And we, as our employer work group, we are focused on really trying to address some of these issues. And that is a critical issue because a 25 cent an hour raise could mean somebody loses a significant benefit on the other side. So we are definitely working on that issue.
How many employers are a part of this program?
So we have 13 employers with a resource coordinator on site. They pay a fee for service. And then we have about 50 employers across the state who have been involved in some strategy, whether it be training or the loan program. And I didn't even mention our financial literacy classes. We're working to bring GED classes and a tax program, a mobile tax program to support the earned income tax credit so people get their taxes done at work.
So Lisa, beyond Working Bridges or incorporating Working Bridges into this idea, what do you recommend to employers who are just perhaps starting to think about the ways that their employees' lives might affect their jobs and how to try to create a better working environment that works for both employees and employers? What's your advice to them?
I would just say that, first of all, they're all welcome at the Working Bridges employer table anytime. But just to remember that a benefit that might seem like a benefit that they would use that might be useful may not meet the needs of all their employees and that they need to possibly take a good hard look at that.
And maybe ask them.
And ask them, exactly.
Lisa Falcone is the director of the Working Bridges program, which is run by the United Way of Chittenden County. Thanks very much for telling us about it.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, how a federal grant program is helping to ensure that Vermont's shooting ranges are safe. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There are about 30 shooting ranges in Vermont where hunters can practice their shooting skills before hitting the woods for any of Vermont's hunting seasons. For the past few years, these ranges, most of them private clubs, have been eligible for federal grants to improve both their safety and their environmental impact. Chris Saunders of the state's Hunter Education Program joins me now to explain more. Chris, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me on.
So Vermont ranges have been tapping into this grant money for 3 years now. And let's talk a little bit about a couple of examples. The Montpelier Gun Club is one example of how the money is used for environmental stewardship. So what was the problem that shooting range needed to solve and use the federal money for?
Well, the club had been in operation since the late 1800s. And, you know, they're right along the floodplain of the Winooski River, and some of their shot was getting into the river, which is, you know, obviously a discharge problem when you look at lead. So they used their grant to construct these giant Kevlar, basically, they look like sails almost. It's basically a shot curtain that they were able to put up along the edge of the river, and that keeps the shot from entering the river. And also, because of the way the curtains work, the shot actually falls to the ground right at the foot of the foot of the curtain, and it really speeds the ability to clean up that lead.
Well, and not only speeds the ability to clean up that lead, but allows them to collect it all and now to sell it to a recycler to cover that matching money in the grant program, which we can talk about. You know, for one thing, how do ranges actually recycle lead?
Well, lead's a valuable commodity, especially right now, in part because of the Chinese market. And it's especially lucrative if you have if you're shooting shotgun on fields where it's easily picked up. And especially down in, you know, the south, southeast, where these clubs can operate it basically year-round, it can accumulate pretty fast. But as you did mention, you know, this is the grant program is actually administered by the Fish and Wildlife Department, but it is federal money that is derived from excess taxes on hunting and fishing, or in this case, hunting and firearms and ammunition. And we use that money to, you know, grant out to the clubs, and they're also required to put up one-third match.
So the clubs have to actually contribute to the improvements. This isn't something where it's just the federal money that they'll be getting. They have to put up a third, as you said.
Yes, actually it's a quarter.
A quarter.
It's a 3-to-1 match program, and that 3-to-1 is actually how the department derives a lot of its funds, because of a lot of our money does come from those same federal sources, and we come up with match through licensed dollars, or in hunter education's case, we use our in-kind volunteer labor from our volunteer hunter education instructors.
So let's talk about another example. The Northeast Kingdom Skeet Club got one of these grants, and that was for safety. What kind of safety improvements did they make?
Actually, most of that was just to improve the facility. It was a fairly forested area. It allowed them to open it up some, make it more attractive to shooters. It also improved their ability to recycle that lead when it comes to that time. So it was less about safety.
But that worked for them as well?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, some people question, well, why does the department care about this? And the fact is we've got 80,000 licensed hunters in this state. And, you know, in 2012, we had no hunting-related shootings. It was the safest year ever. And if we want to maintain that kind of safe record, hunters need safe places, environmentally responsible places to shoot. And one way to do that is to leverage some public access on these nonprofit private shooting ranges through the use of these funds.
Well, talk about that a little bit more, because as you said, one of your goals is to have people be able to practice shooting before they go out in the woods or whatever they're using their guns for. And there is a real shortage of publicly accessible shooting ranges in the state. And I understand that's part of this grant, is making sure there's some public time at these shooting ranges. But is that enough?
No, of course it's not enough. But we do require 20 hours a month, 10 of which must occur on a weekend. And that is for 10 years after the project is completed. In addition, last November, the department opened its first fully publicly accessible shooting range on department land. And we constructed that down in Heartland at the Hammond Cove Fish Access area, where there was a gravel pit that had been used for shooting for years, actually more than years, decades even. And we went in and we just improved the safety and put in some shooting benches and parking area and such. And it's already receiving a lot of use.
I understand that it wasn't as heavily used over the winter, though, as you thought it might be.
No, you know, we don't plow the road. But it's remarkable, you know, especially with folks might receive a firearm for Christmas, how many people are just willing to trudge down in the snow to get down to that facility. And now that, you know, spring has come, it's getting quite a bit of use. you know, in part because there's been some ranges in New Hampshire just across the river that have closed. You know, so there's a decided lack of shooting areas, you know, throughout New England, not just here in Vermont.
So is there any sense that the Department of Fish and Wildlife, if this shooting range, the free and public shooting range in Heartland, is successful, might open others elsewhere in the state to get a good geographical range of open and free shooting ranges?
Absolutely. You know, this is, whether it's the Shooting Range Grant Program or the Hammonds Cove, it's all part of an initiative the department started about 3 or 4 years ago that to really address this lack of shooting ranges and places, safe places to shoot. So we're also, you know, we're basically looking to open one per year, depending on funding, of course, you know, all over the state, particularly, you know, up in the Northeast Kingdom. And there's some areas in the Champlain Valley that are definitely lacking in shooting ranges. We're also working on our Buck Lake Green Mountain Conservation Camp range. This actually, work will be starting soon on that. And in that case, the idea is that on the off season, you know, when the campers are gone, to allow public access there too.
Chris Saunders is with the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Hunter Education Program. We've been talking about the safety and environmental impact of the state's shooting ranges and federal grants that are available to help the state's 30 or so shooting ranges improve on their records. We've also been looking at the accessibility of shooting ranges for Vermont's gun owners. You can learn more about that at vpr.net. And Chris, thank you very much for your time today.
You're quite welcome. And just if there's anyone interested, please contact me. And the deadline is May 15th.
May 15th for those federal grants for improving shooting ranges. Thanks.
Thank you.
And finally today, our weekly look at the topics we can expect to be debated in that hive of activity known as the State House this week. VPR News Director Ross Snead is here to give us the lowdown. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Jane.
So one of the issues that has been a topic throughout the session is the debate over the end-of-life care, and that's likely to be wrestled with this week, although the timing is a little bit hard to predict.
This is going to be very interesting to watch. Now, just a real quick recap of what's happened up to this point. The Senate originated this bill, and it came to a debate in the Senate, and there was a deadlock, and the senators who prevailed really, in the view of people who support this initiative, think the bill was gutted. And so it was approved, went over to the House. The House restored all these things that the Senate had stripped out of the bill. They've now sent it back to the Senate with some other modifications. And the question for the Senate, well, there are a couple of questions for the Senate, but the ultimate one is, what do you do? And the question is, do you ask the Senate to vote on it as the House did it? Do you send it to a conference committee, which would be the traditional way of doing it? Or do you find a way for the Senate to just kind of push it the rest of the way? A couple of different ways you could do that as well. And we'll watch as the week goes on how quickly the Senate actually takes action on this.
Could be as soon as tomorrow, but we're
not
sure.
It could be.
Now, normally the legislature doesn't meet on Mondays, but I understand the House is in session today. And the biggest item on its agenda is the issue of driver's IDs for people who are in the country illegally. And then there's another doozy over in the Senate, although not today. Senators will be taking up marijuana decriminalization later in the week. Lots going on there.
Yeah, marijuana decriminalization could come tomorrow, it looks like. I should interject that it's really unpredictable this time of the year because it depends on what other things are going on. But the driver's ID has become a little bit controversial among farmers. Many migrant workers would qualify for these IDs, and there are some farmers who say it's a bad idea. Marijuana decriminalization, it's a bill that's very similar to what went through the House, decriminalizing possession of 1 ounce or less. The issue is to try to make the penalties for minors, folks younger than 18, the same for possessing alcohol and possessing marijuana.
Okay, and now, Ross, legislators are intent on wrapping up the session, as we know. Leaders say it could happen as soon as this weekend, but the big must-pass bills of the session still haven't even been resolved yet.
No, I really think what usually happens, Jane, is that all these other things that we've been talking about really need to kind of make their way through. I think once we see some kind of decision on the end-of-life care bill, that we'll see some of the roadblock begin to move. But there is a huge issue. Of course, they have to do all the budget bills. bills. But to support the general fund budget, they have to figure out what the tax rates are. And when they do that, they have to figure out whether they can bring the governor along with them, because the governor certainly doesn't like what either the House or the Senate has done, because in between the two chambers, they've pretty much touched all of the major broad-based taxes. And that's exactly what the governor has said he doesn't want to do. We'll have to wait and see whether they make any progress and what kind of noises the governor makes. There's always going to be a smash up at the end. I think they're optimistic to think they can do it by the end of this week.
If you were a betting man, what would the date that you'd pick be?
Well, I think the weekend after is looking awfully good, maybe the 18th.
All right. So I'll probably talk to you next week then.
I think so.
All right. I'll look forward to it. VPR News Director Ross Sneed. Thanks, Ross.
Thank you, Jane.
Also, listeners, don't forget, you can listen to all of the action that happens on the House and Senate floor. So not that committee activity, but the full debates on the floor. We have them on our legislative streams, and you'll find those streams at VPR.net. That's it for today. Tomorrow, we continue VPR's special programming as part of Vermont Reads. We're looking at poetry. So many kids write poetry for class, yes, but also just for fun, and then they stop. We'll take a look at why people seem to stop finding poetry a good outlet for their thoughts and emotions. You can tell us when and why you stopped writing or reading poetry. Write to Vermont Edition at VPR.net. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Tim Johnson. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.